The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Norman, welcome.
Thank you. By the way, thank you for all those good words. As I was listening to them, I was thinking, well, I hope this man knows what he's talking about.
Let me begin by asking you, you have said that Hitler is a reigning mystery. Why Hitler for this book?
Well, if we're going to talk about him as a mystery, I would say that he violates our comprehension of human nature. We know we have various understandings of human nature, the Freudian, the Jungian, the Marxian, the sociological, the anthropological, and they all encompass areas of human nature. But when you get to Hitler, there are elements in him that simply violate our basic notions about humans, our notions about how ugly humans can be or how good they can be. He did something that was unlike anything that any human had ever done up to that point. There have been many leaders before him who were monsters, who killed millions of people one way or another, and were tyrants, delighted in shedding blood. If you compare him to Stalin, Stalin probably is responsible for more deaths than Hitler. But Stalin is comprehensible. Stalin came out of a mental framework that we can comprehend even if we have no agreement with it. Stalin saw people who were opposed to his ideas as villains and enemies, and he also felt that if you were going to oppose him, he was ready to kill you if it came to it. Kill you, starve you out. But everything he did was done out of, how to put it, it was done out of the logic of the situation. Whereas Hitler killed by metaphor. At a certain point, Hitler has decided that the Jews, and for that matter, the Gypsies, and eventually the Poles, were viruses in civilization, that they were hideous presences that had to be destroyed. And so, to repeat, Hitler killed by metaphor. He didn't say there are good Jews and bad Jews. There are some Jews who are my enemies. There are some Jews I possibly could work with. There was nothing of that sort whatsoever. See, Stalin was perfectly capable of making a deal with anyone. But with Hitler, it was a matter of metaphor. The Jews are a virus. They have to be destroyed. If they are destroyed, civilization will straighten out, and we will be on our way, which is an absolute folly as you start to look into it more and more. The idea that you could eradicate any people on Earth and that, therefore, civilization would be advanced is an extraordinary notion, and you have to be, in a perverse way, you have to be a poet to begin to think that way. And Hitler was a depraved poet.
And yet, one of the things I felt when reading this book is a certain amount of grudging sympathy for young Addy Hitler, and which I realized as I'm reading it, and maybe it's more empathy, but and I shudder to say that myself, but I realized as I'm reading it, you also made me feel that with Lee Harvey Oswald. You also made me feel that with Gary Gilmore. I take it that is by design as a storyteller.
Well, part of it may even be my religious bent. I happen to belong to those to that group of people. I don't know whether they're large or small. They do seem to be getting smaller all the time. Those people who believe in God not as a fundamentalist, but in God as a creator, and believe that God, whatever else, gave us, each of us, in one way or another, some inner illumination, some touch of God's spirit, if you will. I also happen to believe, and here, and I'm in a much rarer group, I believe that there's Satanism present as well in human affairs. So given these two poles, I'm straying from your point. The danger when you write a book is no matter who your protagonist is, the reader ends up identifying to some small degree with the protagonist. That's part of the pleasure of reading a book, is to get to know someone who's totally different from yourself, so that very often you can be reading about someone who's a monster and you can be moved by them. In Hitler's case, he was a child at the time, and he was invaded, according to the logic of the novel, by Satan's presence at his conception. That came from the notion that if God was present through Gabriel at Jesus' conception, and after all, a good third of the world must believe that, then it's not too hard for me to assume that if that has any truth to it at all, and it may, for all I know, I wouldn't begin to say it does or it doesn't have that any truth, but if it is true, then it seems to me perfectly reasonable that a satanic intelligence at war with God in the universe, in their part of the universe, would feel that if God has Jesus Christ, I need an opposite number. And it may be that, indeed, Satan was present at Hitler's conception. All right. Because he was present at the conception doesn't mean that the child is owned totally by a devil. You know, a lot of people have said to me, one of the basic criticisms of the novel has been, well, the moment you say that a devil is shaping Hitler, it takes away all responsibility from him. That argument's been used over and over, usually by people whose powers of upper ratiocination are seriously limited.
Reviewers, in other words.
Well, second-rank reviewers. Being a second-rank reviewer is a way of life. Somebody who would have to be far greater than I am, because they would have to have vastly more patience than I do, is someday going to write an enormously wonderful book about the rise of the mediocrities, because the mediocrities are taking over the world. You can see it in architecture. You can see it in airplanes. You can see it in highways. You can see it in the ways in which high leaders speak now.
You notice you don't even have to mention his name.
Oh, it, you know, I'm tired of kicking the poor wretch in the head over and over and over. But, all right, I didn't make my point, or did I? I was wandering off into the wilderness with a point. Oh, about the protagonist. So there is a tendency to identify with your protagonist. In other words, the writer does it to a degree, because if you don't have any sympathy for your protagonist, you've got a novel that's essentially dead in the water before you start. And the reader finds themselves being brought in. But the other element in it, which I think justifies that approach, is it isn't as if Hitler was overnight, because Satan was present, given this premise, Satan was present as his conception, that therefore he was completely a creature of the devil from the word go. No. We have an assistant to Satan telling the story, and this assistant works overtime. He's very much like a highly overworked executive officer in an immense bureaucracy. And he's always trying to please his boss, and often not succeeding. And he makes little changes in Hitler, bit by bit, touch by touch. And by the time the book is over, you can't say that Hitler is born, has now gotten to the point where there inevitably he will be the Adolf Hitler, the monster Adolf Hitler. No, on the contrary, my notion was that the devil had probably been present at, let's make an arbitrary number, at 1,000 conceptions in that part of Germany and Austria, with the notion that this country is going to be ripe for something very ugly, because it's a tremendously unbalanced country at this point, and I'm going to lay my seed. The Near East is going to be excellent. There are going to be other places all over the world that are going to be excellent. But maybe he had 1,000 candidates for Hitler at that point, when the boy turned 15, which is why if one is going to go on with this book and continue it into another book, of the later years, the problem was going to become much more complex, which is, how did Adolf Hitler beat out all the other candidates?
Fascinating. For years, you wrote about yourself as an atheist. Now comes this consideration of God and the devil. So does this mark a shift for you in your thinking?
It's been going on over 40 years. When I was young, I was proud to be an atheist. I thought I was a child of the Enlightenment. And after all, the Enlightenment came a few hundred years ago. And what did it do? It enabled people to say, we no longer have to live on our bellies terrified of God and terrified of the devil and afraid that no matter what we do, we have very little say in our lives. God and the devil determine everything. The Enlightenment being totally opposed to that, believing in reason, believing in human potential, became the leader of untold legions of intellectuals for 200-300 years. And I was one of those children of the Enlightenment, if you will. Now, it seemed to me that over the last 20, 30, 40 years, that there were too many questions now that the Enlightenment was no longer answering, that reason was not sufficient to explain really the complexities and the perversities of human existence. And I began to think that, as an atheist, I began to think, the one question I can't answer is how did we ever get here? How did we go through all the extraordinary stuff we all go through in our individual lives? And all that just came out of some little chance meeting between a few molecules any number of megabillions of years ago. It makes no sense at all. No, I began to think, the trouble with thinking about God is we always think of God as a lawgiver who's going to punish us. And it's meaningless. It ends up with absurdities. It ends up with heaven and hell. It ends up with Club Med and the boiler room.
Right.
And then we start to think of our natures. And there are our natures. You know, here we are. I, as a human being, could be 53% good and 47% bad. And that's modestly good. Modestly good. And or I could be kind of bad. Let's say 41% good, 59% bad. Pretty damn bad. And for that, I got to go to hell and burn forever. And on the other side, someone who's good, 53, 47, goes to Club Med. It made no sense at all. It seemed to me that God was a creator. That was what it was all about. That God was existential the way we are existential. And when I use the word existential, what I mean by it is you get into a situation where you don't know the outcome in advance, so that you are living at a higher intensity of reaction. You can be terrified, you can be exalted, you can feel doomed, you can feel freed, liberated, condemned, but you don't know the answer. You don't know how it's going to turn out. And it seemed to me that God was existential, that somewhere way back, whenever it happened, that God, one of the gods out there in that enormous star-filled universe, decided that this God, he or she, had an incredible conception, that there was something, not only that animals been created, but humans could come out of this. And these humans could carry the vision further forward. God had animals that God thought might be wonderful. God put huge faith into the dinosaurs, and they disappointed them. They died out. God made terrible mistakes. You see, God was existential. God succeeded or God failed. And then adding to that, as I was thinking about all these things and saying, well, this makes as much sense to me as heaven and hell, reincarnation came through the window. It came in by way of the Midwest, because when James Jones wrote From Here to Eternity, we became friends. And I went out to visit him in the early 50s. And at that time, I was a proud atheist. And he started talking about reincarnation. Now, Jones is one of the most practical Midwesterners I'd ever met. And there he was talking about reincarnation. And I said, Jim, surely you don't believe in that stuff, do you? And he said, hell yes, I do. It's the only damn thing that makes sense. Well, I thought about that for 20 years. Because Jones was no fool. And I finally decided, yes, that's the only thing that makes sense. The notion is that God is a creator. Creators want the opportunity to do over again, to work on art objects of theirs in which they failed. And reincarnation is a way to improve the possibilities of certain humans. I work on the notion that God is not all superior to us.
Right.
You see, that God learns from us, just as parents learn from their children. It's not a good parent who dominates children all every step of the way. The fine parent is the one who can learn from the children. In the same sense, I think we were created so that God could get, God having a vision of the universe, could begin to exert that influence. To further complicate the picture, this is all over 40 years of brooding on it. I thought, I've never yet seen a situation in life where there isn't a counterforce to a force. It's always, I started as a Marxist, after all, and there was thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And it seemed to me that was so true that always, you might say it was the last element of Marxism that stayed very much with me, which is for every force is a counterforce, that a force creates a counterforce. Anyone who's been married, even once, and of course, I cannot say that, knows that marriage is an example of that, the force and the counterforce. And out of it very often comes something halfway good, and out of it sometimes comes things that are not so good. But in any event, it seemed to me that you couldn't postulate a creative God without believing there was also present a destructive devil. Why? Because this devil felt that he or she had a deeper view of the universe than God and wanted to take it over. Now, all this is, how to put it, this is the orchestra that you never see in my books, but they're playing all the time in my mind while my characters are reacting.
Right. I want to ask you, I mentioned the Mailer canon earlier, and as I contemplated it, I was thinking about, and you'll pardon the phrase, but that you have bigger balls than any writer I've ever run across, in the sense of when you look at I gave the list earlier, the series of iconic protagonists that you've written about, Hitler and the devil in this instance, but, you know, Ali, Marilyn, JFK, Jesus. Where does that come from, your unwillingness to write a simple book, your bent for understanding these historical iconic characters?
Well, I had a life that was not altogether like others, because I grew up in Brooklyn. I was a nice Jewish middle-class boy in Brooklyn. I had loving parents who had, you know, they were interesting people in their own right, but we were typically middle-class people. I went into the Army. That was the most extraordinary experience of my life. And it followed after Harvard, which was another extraordinary experience. I mean, to come from Brooklyn, from a middle-class environment in Brooklyn, you know, so what are you up to today, you know? I mean, that sort of move, you know. You know, you think you're something special, don't you? To grow up in that environment, and you go to Harvard, and Harvard in those days was something far better than it is now as a sort of a graduated set of steps to business school. And then the Army, which was incredible, absolutely incredible for this delicate little boy from Brooklyn, you see, who had already suffered Harvard and thought that was enough. And then came the incredible business, which was this novel gets written, because it was the only thing I could do. I didn't feel able to do anything else but write. I'd started writing in college, and I felt it was the only thing I was at all good at. So I certainly enjoyed writing. It was very important to me. But, you know, without writing, I felt I was nothing. And then there was the enormous success of The Naked and the Dead.
You're 24 years old at the time?
25 when it came out. 23 when I started, 25 when it came out. And so I felt I was shot out of a cannon, because after that, my relations to people altered totally. They had to alter. I'd walk into a room, and there I was. I was a bird that was different from the other birds. And for years, I used to hate it. I used to think I could have been a wonderful novelist. I could have really been quietly part of the background and picked up a sense of what's going on in this corner of the room, that corner of the room, this corner of existence, that corner. I could have written wonderful novels that were full of genre, full of scenes and places and attitudes and small societies. And instead, I am scrambled. I'm all over the place. And it took about 10 or 15 years before I came to realize that this was not only a personal disaster, having had the huge success of The Naked and the Dead, but that being shot out of a cannon, if it didn't kill you, was very interesting because you saw things in ways other people didn't see them. And so certain kinds of people no longer frightened me with the feeling they're so different. It didn't seem Muhammad Ali was that different. Marilyn Monroe, the common denominator in all of them is they all get shot out of a cannon if you stop looking at it, including, dare I say it, Jesus Christ.
No, that's interesting because I think I remember you writing of Muhammad Ali that he decided at some point to live his life as if he were starring in his own movie. And I think the same could be said of you, and particularly in the way that you then, at some point, I think after Naked and the Dead, decided to embrace the role of public writer, public intellectual. And, of course, that was a time when writers were celebrities.
Yes, and also in France. And I'd had a year in France when I was young, before The Naked and the Dead even came out, where we all lived in the hope that we might be able to see where Sartre was sitting at the café floor. You know, we'd walk up and down by the café floor, by the outdoor tables, hoping maybe the great man would be there. So the idea of the intellectual as warrior was most common in those years. It wasn't that, you know, one had to invent a role. That role was there, and one wanted to exercise a role like that. Today, writers would think, oh, no.
It's back to being polite society. It's back to being the polite society of gentlemanly letters instead of the.
I think that's true to a good degree. And I think part of it, you know, for a variety of reasons, I wouldn't pretend to know them all, but one of the serious reasons, and it's not the fault of the writers, is that the joy of reading has diminished, the joy of serious reading. It used to be that when I was young, the thought of being a serious writer was equal to being a movie star. You know, Hemingway was much more important to me than marvelous people like Clark Gable and Gary Cooper. Now, I wasn't typical, but nonetheless, while not many people knew about Ernest Hemingway, those who did know about him revered him because he was a giant. He was an idol. He was immense. That isn't true today. And I think one of the reasons, and I tend to fulminate a little when I start to talk about it. One of the reasons is television. Because children are fundamentally and systematically dissuaded from serious reading because of commercials. In other words, if they get interested in the story, which is how we all began to read, we were, as children, we were told stories, and then when we started to read, we loved the idea we could curl up with a book and read and read and read, and we developed our intelligences and our sense of the structure of things in society through reading. But now kids do watch TV, and as we all do. And those commercials come in every 7, 10, 12 minutes. So a child gets interested in a story, and then the story is wiped out by a commercial. It's full of color. And if the child's lucky, there's only one commercial. Usually they have 3 or 4 commercials for children in a row. And the result is that kids begin to look for sensation and for quick reactions and for being smart and for doing the right kind of pratfall in a hurry and so forth. And interest in serious reading diminishes every year. And I think the country may be facing a serious problem in time to come unless the entire world becomes more stupid because of TV, which is a real possibility. No, so long as corporate capitalism has given the answer to Karl Marx and is going to show us how to live completely, the more power they have, I will make this prediction, the more stupid humanity is going to become. Because corporate capitalism is the royal kingdom of the mediocrity. Mediocre in architecture, mediocre in morals, mediocre in... Let's not get into it. Mediocre in the products.
You mentioned Hemingway. Do I remember an anecdote of you... correct me if I'm wrong, and this is from a while ago, but George Plimpton is out with Hemingway, says he's going to have Hemingway call you. You had never met him. You had idolized him. They call, and you couldn't bring yourself to answer the phone?
No. That's the story at all. No, legend's dreadful. You know, I lived with the legend that Tallulah Bankhead met me at a party and said, oh, you're the young man who doesn't know how to spell fuck.
Oh, because of Naked and the Dead, right. F-U-G, right.
I didn't meet her until 30 years later. And then she smiled sheepishly. And I smiled dishonestly. No, the real story is more interesting. George Plimpton called me up one morning. This has got to be 25 years ago. And maybe more. He said, Norman, Papa's in town. And he's just, we can date it. Advertisements myself had just come out. So what was the year? 58, was it? I think around there.
That sounds right.
So we're talking about 50 years ago. Good Lord. 50 years ago. And George said, you know, Papa saw the book, and he started looking at it. Excuse me. And he wants to meet you. Well, I said, yeah, all right, okay. He said, look, stay in your house all day. I'm traveling with Papa all day long. And excuse me. And sooner or later, we'll hook up. Well, I was terrified. I was terrified, not only because I was going to meet Hemingway, but because in this book, which George made perfectly clear to me, Hemingway had read every reference to himself. I had said it's years since Hemingway has written anything that would bother an eight-year-old or your grandmother. And I thought, oh, this is going to be one son-of-a-bitch meeting, good Lord. And on top of that, I knew enough about Hemingway to know when he was in New York, he had his court around him. So it would be a matter of coming in like a penitent before the Pope and 6 or 8 or 10 people. So I called up one of my best buddies, a tough young actor named Mickey Knox, and who played gangsters in many a movie. And I said, Mickey, you got to run with me today. You really got to be around. We're going to meet Hemingway, and I need you for backup. And Mickey, in those years, never saw the fight he was afraid to get into. He said, sure, I'll be there. And so he came over, and we waited. And then George called about midday. And he said, look, I'm still having trouble getting Papa grounded. Hotchner is around, and Hotchner was a great friend of Hemingway's in those days. And Hotchner keeps distracting him. So I'll call you back in a couple of hours. And it went on all day long. And all day, I thought, I'm going to meet the king. May I not be humiliated too profoundly. And I just was, you know, I know what the expression tenterhooks means, being on tenterhooks. And then George called back at the end of the day and said, Norman, it just didn't happen. Hutchins distracted Papa completely, and they're off to do something else.
And so you never did meet.
So I never met Hemingway. We exchanged a letter or two. But.
You were talking about television. This is an off-the-wall question. Do you ever watch American Idol?
I do.
Well, what do you
once in a while, what just do you, recently.
What do you think of it? Let me ask you more.
I don't know. I've seen it about 3 times. I gather that I was seeing some of the weaker performers. And I was struck with one element of it. You get someone up there who was wholly talentless. You know, where even I, who don't have that good an ear, could have been one of the judges.
Right.
And they'd sing and they'd be turned down. And then they'd get hurt and they'd feel petty. And they say, I've been studying singing for 12 years and my acting teacher tells me I'm absolutely ready to become a high professional. And I thought, boy, those singing teachers got to be the largest swindlers professional instruction field. And that's about the only reaction I had. I hadn't seen the better ones. And
I asked you because I thought that I imagine I just happened to be watching it when I was reading your book. And I
thank you.
I thought, what would Mailer's reaction to this be? And I thought it would be that this is unfathomable violence that these people are put through. And it's you talk often about the coarsening of our culture. Mm-hmm. I think that is an example of it.
Well, there's no question that it's an ugly show. And it attracts the ugliness in us. And that part, I would agree with you completely. But I was struck with the vanity of the performers, because they really do go through hell.
Yeah.
And they're ready for it. And they're ready for it because, I mean, the one love that one can never give up with any ease at all is that mad, passionate, demented love that one has for oneself. And I saw that show as a study in that.
Yeah. Shall we open this to questions from the audience? What I will do is call on you, and you can wait until the microphone comes to you. So questions for Norman Mailer. Anyone? Yes, right here in the middle. And if you could stand up, that would be great, too.
Let me warn all of you that I'm terribly deaf. And I have my hearing aids in, but that doesn't necessarily solve anything. And Mr. Platt is going to help me. But to the degree that you can speak clearly, which is a power I do not always command myself, it would be a big help.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you speak a little bit about how your service in the military affected your development as a novelist?
Fair question. It gave me more experience in a hurry than anything that had ever happened to me before or since. I was in the Army for about 2 years. And in those 2 years, I probably had 10 years worth of experience. And it was real experience. Real in the sense that young writers go out looking for experience. And very often they say, I want to write a book. I don't have enough experience. How can I find it? And they will do something. They'll take a job. Let's say, as I did once, they'll take a job as a dishwasher. Or they'll take a job doing whatever. The point is, however, that the job is arbitrary. They can quit the job at any moment, as I did indeed as a dishwasher. They know they're not locked into being a dishwasher. When you're a soldier, you're locked in. We didn't know when the war was going to end. We thought we'd be overseas for 5 years, maybe 10. We used to have a ditty, Golden Gate by 48, and this was back in 1943. And so the experience was intense, and it was not chosen. It was not willed. It was experience that we had to accept willy-nilly, whether we liked it or not. And so that experience, yes, that was probably the most profound experience of my life, being in the Army. Some young man, whose name I don't know, went to Andover, which was a very tough, ugly prep school back in 1921. And this man, when he was old, said, my 2 years at Andover were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable. And when I read that, I thought I could say the same thing about the Army. The two worst years of my life and the most valuable.
Yes, all the way in the back.
Once you wrote about Marilyn.
Wait. Wait for the microphone, please.
When you wrote your book about Marilyn, you said that no psychology could explain how she became who she was, and then you said, and so she had to be from a previous life. Reincarnation was implied. And then you said, wherever she reappears, it may be in China, she will be an extraordinary person. What other details do you imagine in your mind will happen when a person dies and when they come back again?
All right. To begin with, don't ask me, and thankfully you didn't, who would you say is Marilyn Monroe today? The point is, we know nothing about reincarnation. I've always felt that reincarnation, if it exists, and I believe it does, is God's ability to employ his or her wit. In other words, I think the reincarnation we're offered is a witty one. It reaches into the core of one's nature. And because reincarnation is so unpleasant a topic for so many people, I have a joke I tell all the time. And I don't necessarily believe this joke, but it is a good joke, especially since it's my joke. And the way it goes is I die. And there I am sitting in this enormous hall, very bureaucratic, very boring, waiting for my name to be called. Finally, it's called. I walk over into the next room, and there's an angel there, monitoring angel, who smiles at me and says, "Oh, Mr. Mailer, nice to meet you. We've been waiting for you. I have good news for you. The good news is that you've been reincarnated. You're going to be reincarnated." Now, we always ask everyone who's going to be reincarnated what you'd like to be in your next life. And so I say, "Well, you know, I thought about this a little. I think I'd like to be a black athlete. Now, I don't care where I'm born. I'll take my chances. But that's why I want to be, a black athlete." And the monitoring angel says, "Oh, Mr. Mailer, we're so oversubscribed." Everybody wants to be a black athlete. Let me see what we have you down for. So he opens the book and looks further, and he says, oh, he says, "We've got you down for a cockroach. But here's the good news. You'll be the fastest cockroach on the block." All right, that's my feeling about reincarnation. We don't dare go near it. That's God's purview. God can learn from us, but we're not going to learn from God in as much of a hurry. And very often there'll be a choice made that might be witty and go to the core of us. Now, I hopefully, that joke of mine is as a metaphor, does not have legs that will carry it very far.
Yes, sir, over here.
Hi. I had a question. I'd heard, I think it was over the internet, that you had met this one author, and he was actually dubbed the new Hemingway, and it's Sebastian Younger. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about him and authors like him.
Sebastian Younger?
Yes.
As the new Hemingway? No, I'm not mocking Sebastian Younger. It's just...
It was in like a magazine. They called
him. Well, I don't know his work too well.
Oh, okay.
He's been up in Provincetown a bit. I think we actually met once.
Well, he's not a novelist, right? Well, he's a nonfiction writer.
He's not
writer.
A novelist. Yeah. And he's a young, adventurous writer.
Right.
But just because you've got a certain capacity and bravery, if you will, for action, doesn't make your... And you can write, doesn't mean you're Hemingway. You know, it's just part of what I call the mediocritization of culture. Everybody's looking for a quick connection in terms of evaluations and standards. And, you know, when I remember after I did the Executioner song, I thought, well, they all had said that I just was so completely wrapped up in my Byzantine style that I couldn't write a simple book. So I showed those motherfuckers. I showed them. I wrote the Executioner song, and I proved I could write simple prose. And by God, it's probably as good as Hemingway's. So I then picked up Hemingway and reread him and bowed my head. I thought, I write a good simple prose, and he writes a great simple prose, and the two are not the same.
Are there young writers out there today that you're excited about?
No, but that's not their fault. I'm not reading them. I'm not reading them. I can't read a good novel these days without getting immensely distracted, because in the old days, when I'd read a good novel, very often I would write a piece of literary criticism about it, because the values of the novel were so important to me. And therefore, if I felt a novelist was going in what I thought was an unhappy direction, it seemed paramount to me to get out there and write about it and talk about what was wrong with the book, what were the values that were being contaminated. Or on the other hand, if someone came along occasionally who was very good, they should be announced. But now all I'm interested in, selfishly, is my own work, because I feel that I have if I have three or four more years left to work, if I do, then I don't want to spend them writing about anything but what I want to write about, which are the novels I want to do yet.
Do you write every day?
When I'm working on a novel. But a novel is something that you, you know, you get ready for a novel. You prepare for a novel. You think about a novel. Before I'll start writing a novel, I may often spend 3 months or 6 months or even a year just reading books that are collateral to the subject and thinking about it and arguing with the books and arguing with what the reality is. Because the marvelous thing about reading history books, particularly if you get into someone like Hitler, is history books depend upon facts. And there's no, I wouldn't say there's no such thing as an honest fact, as a true fact, as an uncluttered fact, as an uncorrupted fact. But a true fact is rare. And so what you get when you read histories are you get structures of slightly warped facts all over the place. And then as a novelist, as a critic reading it, you have to try to say, what was the reality? As I'm reading this, I can see, yes, this happened and that happened, but I don't think that the writer of this history really had a sense of why it happened that way. Now, can I find that sense? And so you begin to think of it in novelistic terms. Because the marvelous thing about writing a novel is you can build a bridge between two facts. And you can build the bridge that way, or you can build it this way, or this way, or you can build it this way, if you will. But the notion behind writing a really good, serious novel is that you can end up creating something that never existed and will never exist, and yet it will have more reality for people than the most carefully produced piece of nonfiction. For the simple reason that it doesn't depend upon facts. It depends upon intuitions. And so someone can come along and read it and find that their intuitions are enriched by the novelist's intuitions. A simple example, if a married woman is having her first affair and she comes across Madame Bovary, it helps to change her life.
Well, and what I'm thinking about when you say that is the sort of revolution that you helped bring to nonfiction journalism, which was introduce novelistic techniques that get to a deeper truth than the merely verifiable fact.
Yes, but that's because my nonfiction books do lean toward fiction. In other words, I push it as far as you're allowed within the formal demands of nonfiction. It seems to me that mood has more meaning than facts when you're describing a scene. Mm-hmm. However, since I, as a novelist, am now taking these facts, many more facts than I would use in one of my novels, and I'm trying to create the mood of the occasion if I was there, which is when I usually wrote about these things, it doesn't mean that my sense of the mood necessarily had to be immensely accurate. Hopefully it was. Hopefully I caught it.
Right.
But I was catching it as a novelist, you see, not as a nonfiction writer.
Right. Let's, yes, over here. There are two over here.
As I was struggling through Clara's fascination with little Addie's anus, mm-hmm. I couldn't help but go back to when I was in college reading advertisements for myself and Time of Her Time. I was very young. It was very impressive. And now when I read it, and I'm not young, I wonder if you can trace the genesis of your fascination with that other orifice.
You mean, why am I so attracted to scatology? Because I think it's one of the remaining mysteries. Seriously, the only things that are worth writing about in my mind are all the things that haven't been nailed down and answered and clarified. If you're a novelist, you're an explorer. And most people, and I find it a fascinating mystery, most people are just endlessly repelled by shit. And they won't give shit a fighting chance. And since I have 9 children, I went through an awful lot of toilet training. And it's fascinating. It's not always agreeable, but it sure is fascinating. And I thought, what could be more important? Adolf Hitler, who was one of the greatest shits who ever lived, how could one ignore his toilet training? how could you ignore the fact that his mother, who adored him, was also absolutely captivated by his little pink asshole? I mean, you have to absolutely face into the human condition. You know, was it Saint Odin of Cluny who said, "Inter ficus et urinam nascimur"? You know, between piss and shit are we born? You know, it's not a popular remark to make in the last 30 years since women's liberation took over the world. But nonetheless, it's there. It's there. It's part of the given. You know,
Norman's getting cooking now.
If we have a huge technological society and we can't look at basics, we're going to build a Tower of Babel that's going to crash. The more ambitious we become as humans in terms of going to the stars and dominating this and dominating that, the more we have to be able to understand the very basics of life. And shit is one of them.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Miller, you've spoken about our society or our world existing of forces and counterforces, and you've talked about the power and effects of corporate materialism. I wonder if you might comment on what you see as a counterforce or counterforces to corporate materialism or corporate capitalism.
All right, good question. When I despair, I see no counterforces. When I try not to despair, it seems to me that it's up to us as humans that if at a certain point enough of us as humans say we are sick and tired of looking at immensely ugly buildings whose function is merely to produce money. We're sick and tired of marketing products that don't necessarily improve that much, but nonetheless are marketed, marketed, marketed. We're sick and tired of having our children affected psychologically and reflexively by commercials all the time. We're sick and tired of being rendered more and more stupid each year. That if that happens, if there's this sort of rebellion within people, then I think maybe some things can happen down the road. Maybe 30, 40, 50 years from now, the corporations may begin to reveal that they too have their internal contradictions. But at the present time, the situation is not attractive. Not only does America have the ugliest architecture in the history of architecture, but so does China. Worse, so does Russia. So does the outskirts of Paris. So does the monolithic, ugly building prevails everywhere. And that's just one aspect of the mediocrity of the arts, of the powerful living arts. There was a time when people lived in houses and neighborhoods that had a flavor. You had to be pretty wealthy to do that today. And until there's a deep inner rebellion in people against what the corporation is doing to our existence, nothing's going to happen. And if this rebellion does not exist, if the corporation is right, and what people are finally interested in is marketing, is buying and selling, and particularly buying, and accumulating more, and accumulating more. And if that's what people are interested in, then I'm gloomy. I just think that we're going to end up in some very unpleasant place a century from now.
Let's take two more questions. Yes, sir, right here.
You just touched on a very important point, which reflects the state of the two major political parties in this country, which are both tied to big corporate money. Do you see the opportunity for the Democratic Party, for instance, to go back to a more populist tradition? Or what do you see as the future of the political system in the country?
Well, if the Democrats win in 08, then I think there's a slight chance they'll begin to inch away a little bit from the corporation. Do I think they can make a rebellion of any dimension? No. No, the two parties have been co-opted. And there's nothing on the outside of those two parties that can stand up and change the given. So in politics, we really have the worst single picture. The fact is that the detestation that people have for how ugly their cities have become is much more a force that may end up changing the way we live 100 years from now than the hope that we have in these parties. Now, that doesn't mean that it's hopeless in politics, because we do have some very interesting candidates coming along. We do have some recognitions in America that we've been acting stupidly for a good many years now, not just for the last 6 years, but maybe for the last 16. If you want to get down to it, we've been acting stupidly ever since the Second World War ended, because whatever notions the Soviet Union had of taking over the world right after the war, they were immensely limited because of the enormous losses they'd had in that war. And by the time you get down 30 years after the war, 40 years after the war, to 1984, I remember I went over to the Soviet Union in 1984 for the first time. I was curious. And when I came back, I was angrier at America than I've ever been, because there was Ronald Reagan talking about the evil empire. And that Soviet Union was not an evil empire. That Soviet Union was not a threat to us. That Soviet Union had come down to the most depressed third world nation I'd ever seen. It was hideous to be there. Everybody was depressed. There was no desire whatsoever to take over the world. There was just a desire to lift a little bit out of one's depression. And I thought, in America now, we've been selling this notion of the evil enemy over and over and over. America now has a huge win on its spirit. And this win could be called Bullshit Mountain. And so long as we live, and of course, George Bush, bless him. Somebody's got to bless him. George Bush, bless him, grew up with Bullshit Mountain. He don't know no better. He thinks Bullshit Mountain is the Garden of Eden. So he talks about terrorist forces that are going to destroy us, that we have to stand up to them. And as a result, I'm going to ask the audience a question because I don't know the answer to it. How many people take airplanes every day in America? What's the number? It has to be millions, but how many? At a guess. Does anyone know? You know, five of you have to have your laptops here. You could find out in 5 seconds. But all right, let's assume for the sake of argument, 5 million people a day in America take airplanes. That means 5 million people a day are taking off their shoes at least once that day. And they're being felt all over. And that's real good for the democracy, isn't it? And for what? Because one guy, one slimy character, who was half demented, on more drugs than anyone had taken since, this one demented guy is trying to light his shoe. And so 5 million of us a day have to take off our shoes whenever we travel. Now, if you had a human acting that way, one human acting that way, where I've got to kill that ant, because if I don't kill that ant's going to destroy the household, we'd have them committed.
To play devil's advocate, 911, you don't think warranted some sort of response?
Yes, it warranted a very serious response, which was to make some effort to get the intelligence services of the European and Western nations and a few of the Near Eastern nations cooperating to a point where they could trust each other enough to sort of root out a few terrorists. That was the way to do it. The answer was not to go to war in Iraq. We went to war in Iraq for a very simple reason, looking back on it now. And there were four factors in it. The war in Iraq really had four people leading us into that war. The first was Karl Rove, and I speak as a novelist. I was not present at this conversation. But as a novelist, I guarantee you the conversation. Rove said to President Bush, "George, we're in pretty good shape." This is after 9/11. He said, "We're in pretty good shape because, you know, we passed the 50-50 mark. More than 50% of the country is stupid now. And we can't be defeated so long as more people in America are stupid than are bright. So we've got to keep them stupid." And the best way to do that is have a war. Because patriotism and stupidity nourish us in a way that nothing else will. And you won't have to worry about Wall Street going up or down, about the Catholic Church having trouble with its priests. You won't have to worry about the FBI being polluted with Russian spies. You won't have to worry about this and that. You won't have to worry about giving those tax breaks to the multimillionaires and billionaires. All you got to do is go to war. We got the country. All right. And George said, he was the second force. He said, I agree to all of that. And then you had Cheney, the wise man, who's the only wise man in the whole gang, mind you. What he said to himself is that if we don't get more control of the oil, if we really don't have a good wrestler's grip on the oil supplies of the Middle East, this country could face the worst depression in its history in 10 years when the oil prices start going sky high, because those Arabs are going to torture us once they get the chance. So we got to go into Iraq and capture the oil, and I don't care what we say about democracy. That's a very good way to go in. And then finally, and here I speak as a Jew, there were all the neocons, and they felt the most important thing after the Holocaust, the horrors of the Holocaust, was to defend Israel. And they're awfully bright people. And very bright people have one small vice, which is they're bright until they cease being bright, and then they're irremediably stupid. And so they thought that they were going to help Israel by going into Iraq and presumably building democracy there. They knew better than that. They knew the Sunnis and the Shiites had hated each other for 1,000 years, and they knew enough to know, or should have known enough to know, you don't build a democracy between two groups of people who each want to murder the other. That you can't get a working democracy out of two gangs of murderers. But they went in anyway, because they wanted to protect Israel. And the result is Israel's in worse shape now than it's ever been in the last 4 or 5 years. So that's what you had were the elements that put us into Iraq. All of them subscribers to Bullshit Mountain. In answer to... All right. 9/11 had to be dealt with on its own terms, not with a war.
I think Bullshit Mountain is a good place to end. I want to thank Norman Mailer. Wonderful. Thank you all. Norman will sign books.
Listen, thank you. That was so well done by you. And,
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.